We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
Here we have the laws of the land that is to be ruled by God. God's people living in God's land under God's rule, and God who rules them is the ruler over all of life, not over any section of it. And the laws, they're all the same, religious, social, ethical, just, moral, whatever they be, they all just get rolled into the same category. This is how God's people are to live in God's land, under God's law. There's not one part of life which is put aside for God, and other parts of life, well, you can do with as you like. You love God in all parts of your life. And so there's tremendous variety of laws all rolled in together. The motivations for which they are to obey these laws are many also, though they boil down to one. You'll find as the different rules come through, the different motivations are given. You do this because God rescued you from Egypt. You treat the slave kindly because, remember, you were a slave once down in Egypt. All kinds of rules, of motivations like that. You're to act differently to the people around about you because you are a holy people, a special people, God's own people. You're to put away certain things because they're detestable to God. They're abominable to him. You kill off certain people because you do not want to be contaminated by the peoples who are opponents of God. All kinds of different motivations. But yet all of them stem from the same relationship with God. We do not have here a code and ethics of absolute morality. We have here the ethics of people who are in relationship with God. That, of course, winds up with a fairly absolute standard, seeing God is the ultimate absolute. But if you can have an ultimate absolute, you ponder that one. But while it has some degree of finality about it, yet it has to do with God's people in God's land living God's way. It's not necessarily, therefore, the rules for how Australia is to live now. Not claiming to be God's people, nor indeed living in God's land. There is that difference to it. But it is the way in which God's people are to live, and therefore has relevance to us as God's people. When we come to each of the sections, therefore, tonight, we'll make some statements of explanation about the laws and read some of the extracts that will highlight for us the core of the message in each of the sections, but we'll also look at the New Testament applications to these laws and think briefly, anyway, about the ways in which we can be applying them to Australia and to Christian people thousands of years later. Any divisions that I give are to a certain extent arbitrary, but chapters 12 to 13 seem to be particularly concerned with the ways in which the people of Israel are to worship God as they come into the land. And their worship of God is to be singular. They're not to worship any other God. They're to worship God in God's way, in God's place. Robin's going to read for us tonight. This, sitting down here she is, so don't worry if you can't see her. Just listen and follow it in your Bibles. If we read, first of all, Robin, if you'd read chapter 12, verses 1 to 5 and 29 to 31.
These are the decrees and laws you must be careful to follow in the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess, as long as you live in the land. Destroy completely all the places on the high mountains and on the hills, and under every spreading tree where the nations you are dispossessing worship their gods. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, and burn their Asherah poles in the fire. Cut down the idols of their gods, and wipe out their names from those places. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way, but you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there for his dwelling. To that place you must go. Verse 29. The Lord your God will cut off before you the nations you are about to invade and dispossess. But when you have driven them out and settled in their land, and after they have been destroyed before you, be careful not to be ensnared by inquiring about their gods, saying, "How do these nations serve their gods? We'll do the same." You must not worship the Lord your God in their way, because in worshipping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire as sacrifices to their gods.
Thank you. When we're settled in the land, you're to worship God. And you're to worship God not in the places where the other people have worshipped God. You destroy all those. You're to worship God in the place God shows you. And you're not to worship God in the ways that the other people worship their gods. You're to worship God only. And you're to worship God only God's way. Very important, this point, you see, because people think that when the Bible's speaking against idolatry, it's speaking against worshipping other gods. Well, it certainly is against worshipping other gods, but it's also against worshipping the true God by idolatrous means. The golden calf was used to celebrate a feast to Yahweh. It was actually representing for them Yahweh, or as God would rightly say, it was misrepresenting for them Yahweh. Idolatry is wrong, and all forms of idolatry that were there in the people before they come into the promised land must be destroyed. In fact, don't even inquire as to the nature of their religious activities. Don't even find out about it, lest you be tempted to follow the false gods. Destroy completely. Now, within the people of God, there may be those who would lead you astray. They too must be destroyed. You must not be led to false worship. The worship of false gods or the false worship of the true God. Either way, you must not be misled. You find about those who would mislead us in chapter 13, and verses 1 to 3, and then 6 to 8, and verse 12, 13. Thanks, Robin.
Verse 1. If a prophet, or one who foretells by dreams, appears among you and announces to you a miraculous sign or wonder, and if the sign or wonder of which he has spoken takes place, and he says, "Let us follow other gods, gods you have not known, and let us worship them," you mustn't listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. The Lord your God is testing you to find out whether you love him with all your heart and with all your soul. Verse 6. If your very own brother, or your son or daughter, or the wife you love, or your closest friend secretly entices you, saying, "Let us go and worship other gods, gods that neither you nor your fathers have known, gods of the people around you, whether near or far, from one end of the land to the other," do not yield to him or listen to him. Verse 12. If you hear it said about one of the towns the Lord your God is giving you to live in, that wicked men have arisen among them and have led the people of their town astray, saying, "Let us go and worship other gods, gods you have not known."
You can guess what the then's going to be, don't you? The then comes down later in that passage, say about verse 15. Destroy it completely. Here are three particular trials to the people of Israel. People within, people whom you love, your own family, people whom you would trust, a prophet who comes in the name of the Lord doing miraculous signs. But beware. Do not be misled by them. Even though the prophet can do miraculous signs, do not believe him because of the signs. If he should say to you, "Turn away from Yahweh, go after the gods," then you know he is false. One of the tests of the prophet is the theological test, as to whether he leads you to God or away from God, the God of Moses, the God who led us out of Egypt. Listen to his message. Do not be awestruck by his wonders. Now, the New Testament picks up these ideas. For the people failed in all the ways that are indicated here. They didn't get rid of the Canaanite religions, but rather were seduced by them. They were misled by prophets and by their own families. In the New Testament, we see Jesus in, for example, John chapter 4, speaking to the woman of Samaria about where is the right place to worship God. And Jesus sees the right place to worship God in the future is in spirit and truth. Neither on this mountain nor on that mountain, he says, but in spirit and in truth. The geographical place of Deuteronomy is no longer significant in terms of Christian worship. It was set up in order to destroy all possibility of being misled by the false Canaanite religions. That is not the problem for the future. Spirit and truth is the nature of Christian worship, and therefore, idolatry is still not to be followed. And a mark of the Christian in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 is the person who has turned away from idols to serve the true and living God. And also, we must be wary of the false prophets who would lead us away. Jesus in Mark chapter 13 verse 22 points out that false prophets will arise doing wondrous signs and miracles, but tells us not to pay attention to them. You need to emphasize this, because so often people today even think that because someone can do a miracle, therefore they must be doing it on behalf of God, therefore what they say must be true, therefore they're to be followed. That is not the teaching of the Bible. The fact that they can do miracles indeed makes them all the more dangerous. You need to be listening with all the more care and attention to whether they are teaching the truths of God or leading you away. Jesus, as with Moses, warns you against prophets who do miracles when they preach against God, when they seek to lead you away from the God of Israel. Chapter 14. Here we find a series of laws which we personally find very strange to start with. Food laws, things that are clean and unclean, clothing that is to be kept separate and distinctive. We must understand the nature of the word holiness. It means to be distinctive, to be separate, to be distinctive, to be distinguished from others because you are peculiar, you're odd, you don't fit in with everything else that's going around about you. The Israelites are called God's peculiar people. That is not an anti-Semitic statement, it's God's statement, unless you think he was anti-Semitic. They are his peculiar, they're his distinctive people, his unusual people. And the essence of the idea of holiness is that they are to live in a way which is different to the peoples that they have conquered, distinctive, even down to what they eat, the clothes they wear, and the like. Robin's reading for us, isn't she? Verses 1 to 3 of chapter 14. We'll get the idea.
You are the children of the Lord your God. Do not cut yourselves or shave the front of your head for the dead, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God. Out of all the peoples on the face of the earth, the Lord has chosen you to be his treasured possession. Do not eat any detestable thing.
Go down to verse 9 and 10 too, if you would, Robin.
Of all the creatures living in the water, you may eat any that has fins and scales. But anything that does not have fins and scales, you may not eat, for it is unclean.
Now, see, they're very strange rules, aren't they? Missing out on prawns, lobster, all kinds of good things. But the essence of the idea is that of being holy. And the things that they are forbidden to eat, you will find frequently, although not every occasion can we find it, you will find frequently are things of the other religions in the Middle East at that time. The mourning habit of shaving the front of your head for the dead. They're not to be like the people around about. They are to be different. And their diet
marks off their difference, distinguishes them, and the clothing they wear or don't wear marks it off, that they are different. They're not to engage in any of the religious or even, it would seem, social practices of the people they are overthrowing. Now, when you come to the New Testament, the question of the cleanliness and uncleanliness of food has become an enormously important one in Pharisaic thinking. They're very concerned as to the fact of what is clean and what is not clean, and how you can be contaminated by everything that is unclean. But Jesus, especially in the passage in Mark chapter 7 and the opening 20 or so verses there, challenges their whole notion about cleanliness and uncleanliness. The food itself is not what is important, he says. Indeed, Mark says he declares all food clean. For after all, the food just goes into your mouth and on down into the sewerage. It's out of the heart of man that comes uncleanliness. They have taken the very symbol of being a different people and turned it into what they think is the spiritual principle, that there are some foods which are of them very self unclean and spiritually contaminating. They've misunderstood the principle severely, and Jesus roundly attacks them on the matter in Mark chapter 7. They've turned the symbol into the reality. You also find it in Acts chapter 10, where Peter has that weird vision, if you remember, of all the animals being lowered down in sheets from the sky and told to get up and eat. And he says, I've never eaten any of those unclean things. And God says, don't call what I have made unclean. The creation is never unclean. For a special reason, for the history of the people of Israel, their holiness was to be marked out in what they ate and what they did not eat. But yet the things of the world are clean and not of themselves contaminating. It has to do with their religious associations back in the times of the Canaanites. So does that mean now that Christians are not to be distinctive? That unlike the Jews, we can be just like our neighbours? No, no, the New Testament still talks about our holiness, still uses the word. In fact, a Christian in the New Testament is not called a Christian very often. The word Christian only occurs three times in the New Testament. That's not our word of ourselves. If you want to describe us, we're saints. That is the New Testament word, saints. Christians are all saints. All saints are Christians, and all Christians are saints. That doesn't mean that we wind up in stained glass, but it does mean that we are distinctive, because the word saint is the word holy. It's the same Greek word. We are the holy ones. Now, as soon as it says the holy ones, it sounds like, you know, we're kind of walking around with little halos hanging over our heads and sick mullet grins on our faces in long white robes. Well, some of us maybe, but that is not the nature of holiness, you see. That is the nature of being distinctive, but being distinctive on the outside. The holiness of the New Testament is a distinctiveness of our quality of life. We're to be distinctive in that we tell the truth. We're to be distinctive in that we love our neighbour. We're to be distinctive in our peace and patience and kindness and gentleness. In the response to God of our whole lives, we are to be distinctive. But we are called to be holy just as the people of Israel were called to be holy. Not in the foods that we eat, but in the truth we speak, in the kindness and gentleness with which we live. 1 Peter is a marvellous passage, 1 Peter chapter 1. On the call to the holiness of Christian living. And so Christians wind up in 1 Peter 2:9 as being the peculiar people, the special people, God's own people, marked out from all around about us. Through chapters 14, the end of it, and all through chapter 15, you'll find there are a series of laws and rules, regulations that are loosely linked around the theme of finances and concern especially for the poor. There are rules in verses 22, 23 to 29 about tithing. There's rules about the release, the seven-year release. There's rules about the firstborn. How about we read the tithing ones first, Robin, from chapter 14, verses 22 to 3 and 28 to 29.
Be sure to set aside a tenth of all that your fields produce each year. Eat the tithe of your grain, new wine and oil, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks in the presence of the Lord your God at the place he will choose as a dwelling for his name, so that you may learn to revere the Lord your God always. Verse 28. At the end of every 3 years, bring all the tithes of that year's produce and store it in your towns, so that the Levites, who have no allotment or inheritance of their own, and the aliens, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns may come and eat and be satisfied, and so that the Lord your God may bless you in the work of your hands.
You see how the relationship with God lies as the motivation in these kinds of commandments. Notice also that tithing is very difficult to apply to Christian giving at the moment, isn't it? Because what do you do with your tithe, with your tenth? You eat it. Right? You give it away? Well, hardly. You give it to God and then consume it yourself. You're to gather the first tenth because that actually will help you to revere God, to set aside this in particular. And notice it's the first part of the crop that you do it with. You give to God in thanksgiving to him that he has given it to you. But notice also in the eating of the tithing in verses 28 to 29 that you make sure every third year that the poor get caught up in it. And throughout the book of Deuteronomy, and this section of it, you'll see concern for the poor, that within Israel there were not to be poor Israelites. They were to look after the widows, look after the Levites, who after all didn't have their own plot of land. They were the ministering priests and the like within the community. They weren't involved in agriculture, but they were involved in maintaining the services of the temples and the like, the tabernacle as it was then, of course. And as such, they were given a tenth, they were given a share in your tenth. And so the Levites could stand the possibility of being very impoverished if people didn't remember them. The widows, the orphans, they are the people who are easily overlooked. But God makes provision for them. But then down in chapter 15, there is also the concern for the poor man who is in debt. We read in chapter 15 the first couple of verses, and then pick it up again in verses 12 to 13 and down to verses 12 to 13. We'll leave it there for a moment.
At the end of every 7 years, you must cancel debts. This is how it is to be done. Every creditor shall cancel the loan he has made to his fellow Israelite. He shall not require payment from his fellow Israelite or brother, because the Lord's time for cancelling debts has been proclaimed. Verse 12. If a fellow Hebrew, a man or woman, is sold to you and he serves you 6 years, in the seventh year you must let him go free. And when you release him, do not send him away empty-handed.
Right, you'll find that these laws relate only to the Hebrews. So, for example, in verse 3, you may require repayment of a foreigner. That's all right. But you must cancel any debt your brother owes you. Within Israel, there is to be no poverty. Yet within Israel, there will always be poverty. Both things are said in this passage. There's to be no poverty because the fellow Israelite is always to be treated generously. And at the end of every seventh year, his debts are to be cancelled. At the end of every seventh year, if he's sold himself into slavery, he's to be released or allowed to go free. That's not the rules for what you do with a foreigner. You can take them down all you like, for any length of time, it would seem. But for the fellow Israelite, that is the law. Because God's inheritance is a rich inheritance given to all the people to enjoy to the full, and not for a select group. Great leavening, egalitarian principle that's involved in the community at this point, isn't there? For God's concern for them. Then in verses 19 and 21, there is another one of setting aside the tenth, the firstborn, in sacrifice. But we won't read that particularly. Now, in the New Testament, generosity is encouraged, say in passages like 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. Visiting the widows and the orphans is seen to be true religion in James 1, 27. But there is still the distinction between our generosity to the household of faith and our generosity to all people. Galatians 6:10 is an interesting verse in that respect, for it says, "Do good to all men, but especially to the household of faith." The people of Israel were indeed a blessing to the nations who cared to live with them. But they had a particular responsibility for their brothers. Likewise, Christians have a particular responsibility for their fellow Christians while they are still to do good to all men. By this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love for everybody. Is not what Jesus said. If you have love for one another, there is to be something distinctive about the way in which Christians are to treat each other, just as there was something distinctive about the way in which the Israelites treated each other. And that distinctiveness has got to do with love and generosity that we need to pay careful attention to in our age. But the New Testament takes up this passage in another way as well. For the New Testament sees the coming of Jesus as the coming of the year of release of God. That as all debts were to be forgiven on the seventh year, as all prisoners were to be, all slaves were to be released, so with the coming of Jesus, the year of God's release is proclaimed. Not release from economics, but release from the captivity, not of slavery economically, but slavery to sin. Luke chapter 4 picks up the idea when Jesus speaks in the synagogue in Nazareth, the first sermon he preaches in Luke's Gospel in chapter 4, where he quotes Isaiah 61, which refers back to this kind of regulation, the idea that you are to release them. You'll also notice in this section that the Pharisee is put down. He's already thought of in this passage because there is that mentality which says it's the sixth year this year, I'm not going to lend anybody anything. Now next year, seventh year, I can't lend him anything, but the eighth year, that's the start of the new cycle, I can lend him, and I've got all those years of my debt. It's a worthwhile proposition to lend a man something in the first year. That's all right, but can you imagine lending somebody something this year knowing that next year you have to cancel the debt? And the Pharisee in us is like that and is condemned. I'll come back to that in later, because this whole part of the book of the Bible requires application. The Pharisaic method of application is one that is available, and it is wrong. The principle upon which we're to apply it is not to seek to minimise the commands of God, but to find the principle of them and apply them to the full. Jesus does that. He does it about himself, and he does it for us. Tithing is not the appropriate response of the Christian man. It's too mean. We're to give everything, not 10% of net or gross. We're to give freely and generously, as God himself has in the person of Jesus. There's some of the applications that come to us today. Derek, why don't you lead us in prayer so we can spend... But now, doing away with the old yeast that riddled our lives and our society and our community, the old yeast of wickedness and malice, get away with that and come into sincerity and truth. Picks up on the festival. The festival of the Passover, and sees that we've had it already in the person of Jesus. Well, you can see that the New Testament applications, you can't just work on one principle. There's all kinds of different bits and pieces that may be related to in the New Testament. So Russell's going to read to us several of the sections from chapter 16 through to chapter 18. He'll read chapter 16, 18 to 20. Chapter 17, there's several different verses there, 2 to 7, 8 or 2 to 9, 14 to 15. And chapter 18, there's some sections too, aren't there, Russell? I've forgotten what they are here.
Verse 20.
I'm sure it's more than verse 20. 14 to 20. 2. 14 to 22. Yes, that's better. That whole section.
Right, verse 18 of chapter 16. Appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God is giving you, and they shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. Follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land the Lord your God is giving you. chapter 17, verse 2. If a man or woman living among you in one of the towns the Lord gives you is found doing evil in the eyes of the Lord your God, in violation of his covenant, and contrary to my command, has worshipped other gods, bowing down to them or to the sun or the moon or the stars of the sky, and this has been brought to your attention, then you must investigate it thoroughly. If it is true, and it has been proved that this detestable thing has been done in Israel, take the man or woman who has done this evil deed to your city gate and stone that person to death. On the testimony of two or three witnesses, a man shall be put to death, but no one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. The hands of the witnesses must be the first in putting him to death, and then the hands of all the people. You must purge the evil from among you. If cases come before your courts that are too difficult for you to judge, whether bloodshed, lawsuits, or assaults, take them to the place the Lord your God will choose. Go to the priests who are Levites and to the judge who is in office at that time. Inquire of them, and they will give you the verdict. Verse 14. When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, "Let us set a king over us like all the nations around us," be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your own brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother Israelite. Chapter 18, verse 14. The nations you will dispossess, listen to those who practice sorcery or divination. But as for you, the Lord your God has not permitted you to do so. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him. For this is what you asked of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, "Let us not hear the voice of the Lord our God, nor see this great fire any more, or we will die." The Lord said to me, "What they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him. If anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, must be put to death. You may say to yourselves, "How can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord? If what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is the message the Lord has not spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously. Do not be afraid of him."
All right, there's a variety of things, isn't there? It's about officialdom. You see the appointment of judges and of law courts and of the king. Section we didn't read at the beginning of chapter 18 about the priests and the Levites and how they've got different roles and they've got different ways of being provided for. And about the prophet in verses 14 to 22 of chapter 18. And it's about the way in which justice is to be implemented. And you see the appeal courts coming in verses 8 following of chapter 17. And indeed the case of those who would show contempt of the court in chapter 17 verse 12, a section we didn't read, is raised. God is bringing justice into the land and setting up a series of courts, of administrators, of officials. Each of them is to live under the law, even the king himself. Verses 18 and 19 of chapter 17 tell us that he is to make sure that he reads the law and has it read to him, and he has a copy of it, for he has to live under it. And he is only one amongst equals. He is not to place himself above others, even though he is the king. Now, how are we going to see these kinds of sections, these two chapters or so, applied to us today? What does it mean for us now, on this side of the New Testament? Why don't you do some work on thinking about it? Yeah, in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, the immoral person within the church is told to be dealt with. And the argument of Paul quotes this section of Deuteronomy. The last verse of 1 Corinthians chapter 5, isn't it? Verse 11. Sorry. Sorry. Now I'm writing that you must not associate with anyone who calls himself a brother, but is sexually immoral or greedy, an idolater, a slanderer, a drunkard, or a swindler. With such a man, do not even eat. It's verse 13 that actually quotes back the Deuteronomy section. What business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? Are you not to judge those inside? God will judge those outside. Expel the wicked man from among you. That principle of keeping the congregation pure. Mind you, how you do it in verse 13 is very difficult in 1 Corinthians 5, but we did a tape on it and spent a lot of time discussing that some years ago, and you can borrow the tapes after church. They're up there in the corner up there, and with the tape library people would love to see you. Be interesting to see if they've got that one on stock, yes. So there's one of the illustrations, that the purity of Israel is to some extent applied in the New Testament to the purity of Christianity, of Christians, of the church. Mind you, not to the extent of taking arms and killing them. There is a difference, because we do not rule the world like that now. Yeah, what else can you see applications in the New Testament? To be scrupulous about ourselves before we judge other people. Yes, the whole carefulness of judgment is there, isn't it? Two or three witnesses. You don't accept things just on one. Especially against elders, you don't take it. But the judgment on the basis of evidence. You see, this is all commonplace for us, isn't it? I mean, this is what you expect in so-called British justice, isn't it? But it's not commonplace in the ancient world. This is radical new thoughts. This is revolutionary ideas. That the king is under the law, that the judges are not to be people of bribes or partiality, that they're actually to listen to the witnesses and to only accept the evidence on two or three witnesses. And then comes that lovely statement about if the witnesses, that's down in verse 6 and 7 of chapter 17, that if the witness proves to be false, then you do to him what he wanted you to do to the other bloke. That's a lovely way of making sure the witnesses are straightforward, isn't it? And it's encaptured in the idea of remove the speck from the log from your own eye before you start chasing out specks in other people's eyes. It's the same kind of idea, isn't it? Yeah, how else do we see it? Whole principles of justice and judgment, yeah? How else do we see it in the New Testament? Yeah. The leaders are people under God and just amongst the equals, yep. Very little hierarchical thinking in the New Testament or in the Bible as a whole. Extraordinary, you see. Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom to many. The leaders are called servants. They are the leaders. How did the surrounding nations work their justice? Unfortunately, all differently, and so I can't define it quickly. Some of them, like Hammurabi's code, is not bad in terms of justice. Some of them, though, were just straight out barbaric, and the king's word was law, and if he changed it daily, so did the law change daily. And so if they didn't like the way you did your hair, well, that was tough if he saw you. He was just the fiat of the king. I mean, he just made up his own mind what he wanted to do this day, that day, or any other day. People lived in terror of their kings. But the king of Israel is quite different. The king is under the law, because the king is under God. Other nations tended to think God, the king, was God. Very big differences being made here. Yes, the payment for the Levite section is used in the New Testament as the argument why you should pay those who preach the gospel and minister the gospel to the community. Yep. It's one of those parts where Jesus' words in Luke's gospel are quoted in 1 Timothy as being the scripture. That the labourer is worthy of his hire is not found in the Old Testament, it's only found at the lips of Jesus in Luke's gospel, but Paul in 1 Timothy says that it's actually the words of scripture. There's an interesting piece of miscellaneous information for you to carry around. Very useful one, though. Well, the big application you are missing. Think harder and work at it. What is the big application? Well, you had a go here, yes? No? Tony? The prophet, yes, in chapter 18, verses 14 to 22. God is going to raise up another like Moses. Another like Moses, a prophet. Turn with me quickly to John's Gospel, will you? Let's just trace it out in John's Gospel, you'll see the point. Go to chapter 1. They confront John the Baptist and say to him, "Are you the Elijah?" In verse 21, chapter 1, 21 of John's Gospel, "Are you the Elijah?" He said, "I'm not." "Are you the prophet?" He said, "No." He was a prophet, all right, but he wasn't the prophet. Which is the prophet? It's the one of Deuteronomy 18, the one like Moses. Go to verse 45. Where Philip and Andrew and Peter have met up with him, and Philip goes and finds Nathanael and says, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Now that may not be referring to the prophet, but he clearly sees that he's been foretold in Moses. Turn with me to chapter 5, verse 46. Chapter 5, verse 46. Jesus said, "Your accuser is Moses, on whom your hope sets. Your hopes are set. If you," verse 46, "if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me." Where did Moses write about him? Well, go to chapter 6, verse 14 of John. Chapter 6, verse 14. "After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, 'Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world.'" It's a dangerous, silly response, isn't it? Because just because a bloke does a miraculous sign is no indication that he is a prophet, a true prophet, let alone the prophet. But that was their response. They could see Jesus as that. Go to John chapter 7, verse 40. John 7, verse 40. Jesus makes his great proclamation about the coming of the Spirit. And he says, and we read, "On hearing his words, some of the people said, 'Surely this man is the prophet.' Others said, 'He is the Christ.'" The people are identifying Jesus as the prophet. Now, they're not wrong. Because if you remember on the Mount of Transfiguration, we find that God says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." Just as we're told that we must listen to the prophet when he comes. And in fact, in Acts chapter 3, verses 22 and 23, Acts 3, 22, 23, we read Peter's preaching and saying, "For Moses said, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people, and you must listen to him, to everything he tells you. Anyone who doesn't listen to him will be completely cut off from among his people.'" And Peter identifies him as the Jesus. The New Testament sees this as one of the important prophecies foretelling Jesus. He is the prophet to whom we must listen. We must pay attention. Those who do not pay attention will be cut off. In this, there's also a test of prophecy again. Another test is given. What the prophet says will take place if he's a true prophet from God. No, it's not really that. It's the negative test. If it doesn't take place, then you know he wasn't a true prophet. If it does take place, you don't know, do you? But if it doesn't take place, you do know. It's a negative test. Very good one, though. I've had people come to me with prophecies. And several of them have come to me with prophecies. And every one of them has not come to pass. So I'm not fearful of any of those prophets. There is an application. So how does the New Testament apply? Well, again, in Jesus, but again in principles. Both those ways you apply this kind of writing to ourselves. Through Jesus, who fulfills it explicitly, and through ourselves, in the way in which we treat people with justice and righteousness, in the way in which we discern the true prophet. The next chapter is a simple one. It'd be good if we just moved along so as to keep us girls going. It's the war policy one. It has almost no applications to us through the New Testament, The New Testament doesn't quote it or allude to it. It basically says you must destroy. In this, there's also a test of prophecy again. Another test is given. What the prophet says will take place if he's a true prophet from God. No, it's not really that, it's the negative test. If it doesn't take place, then you know he wasn't a true prophet. If it does take place, you don't know, do you? But if it doesn't take place, you do know. It's a negative test. Very good one, though. I've had people come to me with prophecies, and several of them have come to me with prophecies, and every one of them has not come to pass. So I'm not fearful of any of those prophets. There is an application. So, how does the New Testament apply? Well, again in Jesus, but again in principles. Both those ways you apply this kind of writing to ourselves. Through Jesus, who fulfills it explicitly, and through ourselves, in the way in which we treat people with justice and righteousness, in the way in which we discern the true prophet. The next chapter is a simple one. It'd be good if we just moved along so as to keep us girls going. It's the war policy one. It has almost no applications to us through the New Testament. The New Testament doesn't quote it or allude to it. It basically says you must destroy everybody close to you and nobody far away from you unless they ask for it. Russell's going to read to us verses 1, 10 to 13 and 16 to 18.
When you go to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army greater than yours, do not be afraid of them, because the Lord your God, who brought you up out of Egypt, will be with you. Verse 10. When you march up to attack a city, make its people an offer of peace. If they accept and open their gates, all the people in it shall be subject to forced labor and shall work for you. If they refuse to make peace, and they engage you in battle, lay siege to that city. When the Lord your God delivers it into your hand, put the sword to all the men in it. Verse 16. However, in the cities of the nations the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave alive anything that breathes. Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Otherwise, they will teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshipping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God.
Well, aren't you glad we're not Australianites, eh? Well, those people, those ites, they get a terrible battering in the scriptures. Okay, here is the war policy. The locals must be destroyed because they'll contaminate you. The people further afield, well, go and try and make peace with them in the first place and let them be your slaves, but if they won't like it, then do them in, but don't destroy them in the same way. In all of it, we're to trust in God. Verse 1. For he is the one who gives them the victory. Okay, where do you see that applied in the New Testament principles, though? How do you see that as a Christian? What do Christians do with chapter 20? If you catch a Jebusite, kill him. What are we going to do with it now? Has it got anything to say to us? Bruce? Right, we still may look at the question of avoiding contamination, though not in the same way. Right? Especially within our own land. It's people close to us who are always the greatest danger, and you'll find the New Testament does speak about being aware of false prophets, false apostles. It's the people who are within the church who are the greatest danger to the church. Always. The atheist never worries me greatly. I know he's wrong. It's the bishop. He's the one you've got to be worried about. Because occasionally he's right. And therefore he's very much more dangerous to you. Yeah? Yes, and so it's the same kind of thing again, isn't it? Is that right? Have I understood that Peter telling
Jesus telling Peter to get behind him because he's actually speaking the words of Satan, not the words of God. Yeah? Not to be afraid against the enemies of God, Brad. That's excellent. Now, who are the enemies of God that we're not to be afraid against? Yeah, people who oppose the truth. We needn't be fearful of them. Who else? Satan. All right. Where else? How else can we see the New Testament picking up the idea of our fight with Satan? Where are you going to find that? I've given it away for you now, haven't I? Ephesians. Give me a chapter for it. You only had one out of six to pick, didn't you? And you got the right one. Yeah, chapter 6, verses 10, following. You see, we do not fight against flesh and blood. Now that shows you immediately what to do with this passage. This passage is not about our warfare. It's not about our warfare. Our warfare as Christians is not against flesh and blood. Our warfare is against the powers and principalities of darkness that live in the heavenly places. Ours is a spiritual warfare that we're engaged in. Therefore, we mustn't move from this passage onto what Christians should be doing as we move into South America and conquer the Aztecs. That is not the way of advancing the kingdom of God. It's nothing like that, you see. We're not wrestling with flesh and blood, but with the powers and principalities of the evil forces. And therefore, our armament and our method of fighting is still the same. Trusting in God, His ways, but fundamentally different. Our armament is faith, is the gospel, is prayer. They're the kinds of things. And so you get the whole armour of God. There are a couple of other applications that you can bring to it, but I'll come back to that fighting with the armour of God in a second. There's a couple of others you can. I mean, it does rule out the question of being a believer in God and a pacifist simultaneously, doesn't it? I mean, chapter 20 is fairly dead set against pacifism, isn't it? The pacifists, if anything, are sent home. Godly go into fight. I think that's the other key one. Now, who can think of a hymn? What is to choose your own hymn, but make sure it's the one I'm thinking of. A follow out simply and just with a few readings. There are three headings, though, that all get summed up under. The first one is justice, the second is charity, and the third is purity. And each of the different rules and regulations you will find are an expression of justice or charity or purity. I'll give you an example of what I mean by each of them, but you have to read the whole chapters and sort them out yourselves later on. For example, if you turn to chapter 22, verse 8, there is an example of the law concerning justice. When you build a new house, make a parapet around your roof so that you may not bring the guilt of bloodshed on your house if someone falls from the roof. You could actually enact laws like that through your local council today, couldn't you? They're laws that try and tie down who is responsible for what, so as to make sure that people act responsibly and that justice is done. For example, another one, chapter 24, verse 16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their fathers. Each is to die for his own sin. See, it's a whole principle of justice that is being enunciated. And many of the rules and regulations you find in these chapters are like that. The second type are those which are concerning charity, generosity. So, for example, in chapter 24, we'll stick down there, for example, in verse 19, when you are harvesting in the field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the alien, the fatherless, the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat the olives from your tree, do not go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. When you harvest the grape in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this. See, they're to act generously. They're to act generously, especially to those who are without. That's not a principle of justice as such, but going beyond justice. I mean, they're my grapes, they're my olives. It's my sheaf. But God says, no. You know what it was like to do without. You know what it was like to be a slave. You know what a tremendous boon it was to come across something that had been left behind, something that had fallen off the back of a truck, so to speak. Well, make sure that if something does fall off the back of your truck, that you don't back up and go and find it and stop the widow and the orphan from having their great treat.
charity. The third one are concerning purity. And these are holiness ones. For example, go back to chapter 22 and you'll see some there. It's got to do with, for example, a woman must not wear men's clothing, nor a man wear women's clothing. For the Lord your God detests anyone who does this. Not just the detesting of the thing, but of the person ultimately in that one. Or again, down in verse 10, do not plough with an ox and a donkey yoked together. See, one was a clean beast, one was an unclean beast. You're not to put the clean and the unclean together. Or again, the making of the tassels on the four corners of the cloak you wear is explained elsewhere in the scriptures as the tassels which are to remind you of the law and that you're to be obedient to it. And so there was to be distinctive clothing that would remind you of who you were and how distinctive, how holy, how pure you were to be as a people. In chapter 23, in verses 1 to 8, there's descriptions of whom you allow into the assembly of Israelites and whom you don't, and under what circumstances, when you can accept an Ammonite in and a Moabite in, not even after the 10th generation. But those who come from elsewhere get in a little bit more easily, like the Edomite and the Egyptian. So there's a whole series of rules and regulations, and they can, I think, be summed up under those three principles. One's got to do with justice, another with the principle of charity, and the third with their holiness, with their purity. Now, many of these, of course, come across into the New Testament. The justice ones often do. The charity ones often do. The need to love your neighbour, to do justly towards him, and to be generous towards him. Some of the laws about divorce in chapter 24 are particularly discussed in the New Testament by Jesus. But even some little ones are picked up. For example, chapter 25, verse 4. Do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. Now you would think that's a simple law. It's a law of justice to the animal or charity to the animal, depending on how you want to view it. But yet in the New Testament, it's seen as being about paying clergymen. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 9, we read, for it is written in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading up the grain. Is it about oxen that God is concerned? Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? Yes, it was written for us, because when the ploughman ploughs and the thresher threshes, they ought to do so in the hope of sharing in the harvest. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? That is, here is a good example of the way of applying these laws of justice and charity and purity to us. The Pharisee, you see, would say, well, I mustn't muzzle an ox while he threshes, but it doesn't say anything about the horse. Therefore, always thresh with a horse. And you can muzzle them all you like, because after all, it doesn't say not to muzzle the horse, does it? The whole Pharisaic method of interpreting the law was to minimise its requirements. But the New Testament method of Jesus and of Paul is the exact reverse. Is to go for the guts of the matter, the very heart of it, the very centre, the kernel of it, and say, what is on about here? It's on about the fact that those who are involved in the labour have a right to expect return from their labour. Now, it's not just about oxen and muzzle. That's just... Let's think about it in terms of any aspect of life. Even in the aspect of Christian ministry, that they should expect some return for the labour they're engaged in. So he takes it to apply to quite many, many situations. Now, that's an important one for us to grasp hold of in terms of principle. For example, in the idea of justice here, you'll find there are laws about what to do with the poor man. What to do with a man in terms of taking a loan. What to do in terms of paying him his wages. The social system they're talking about is very much more primitive to the now high-flying financial system here in the Western world now. But the principles are still the same. Clergyman spoke to me the other day, clergyman's wife spoke to me the other day about the fact that this is not our church. I praise God that's not our church. You are acting responsibly through your representatives. But this clergyman's wife pointed out that they only get paid monthly, which is the normal for clergy, and
It's the 15th day of the month that clergymen get paid, or something like that, I think it is. Whatever it is. Anyway, it's about the 15th of the month. And they find it very difficult when you only get paid monthly, especially on 5-week months, to keep their budget. And the church treasurer, who's a very wealthy man, really doesn't understand how close to the wind they're sailing. And quite often he will forget to pay them on the 15th of the month. And he'll only ever pay them on a Sunday. So if the 15th falls on a Monday, well, you see, they don't get their pay until the 21st or something like that. And that extra week really does mean a lot to them. But very often when he turns up, he forgets to have brought the check. And so they don't get paid for a week or so after that. Now, if you're a rich man, that really doesn't matter to you very much. But if you live with no savings from month to month, that matters an enormous amount. Now, very often, friends, the milkman, you need to pay him straight away. Don't carry the debt for weeks and weeks. That's not kind to him. Why should he be carrying you? Your garage bill, your whatever it is, pay your bills immediately. You don't know the financial situation of the person to whom you're paying, and you owe it to him. Do not be people in debt. Romans chapter 15 verse 8 says, owe no man anything but love. Very powerful, isn't it? Owe no man anything but love. You're in debt? Make sure you pay it off as quickly as you can. You see how a passage here about the law, just dealing with little matters, matters of a society far removed from our society, yet they're principles that you can find, if you don't think pharisaically, they're principles that can flow on to the whole way in which we live, even in this technical society. Why don't we pray about that before we look at this last section and sing a hymn of praise? Would you like to lead us in prayer again, Derek? In verses 16 to 19, there's no verse 20, 16 to 19 is a summary of all that has gone before. Russell, why don't you read that for us, please, that last few verses.
Verse 16. The Lord your God commands you this day to follow these decrees and laws. Carefully observe them with all your heart and with all your soul. You have declared this day that the Lord is your God, and that you will walk in his ways, that you will keep his decrees, commands, and laws, and that you will obey him. And the Lord has declared this day that you are his people, his treasured possession as he promised, and that you are to keep all his commands. He has declared that he will set you in praise, fame, and honour high above all the nations he has made, and that you will be a people holy to the Lord your God, as he promised.
Thank you. You see, the ultimate rationale behind it all is verse 19. They are a people holy to the Lord. It's because they are his special people, they are to live his way. His way involves all kinds of things, doesn't it? What to do with your neighbour's sheep, to the clothes you may wear, to the tassels on the end of your coat, from great principles of justice, rules about kings, and also about poor people and how you care for them, and what you even do about shaking your olive tree twice. The whole of life comes under it because they are God's people living in God's land, and they are to live God's way. They're to love the Lord their God with all their strength, all their mind, all their might, all their lives, all their everything. That is how they are to live. In 1 Peter 2:9 it is said that we, under the gospel, are God's peculiar people, God's special possession, God's holy people. We are to live as God's people, inheritors of his kingdom. That is our privilege and responsibility. And it doesn't affect some part of life. It affects the paying for your milkman. It affects your whole attitudes to justice and righteousness. It will affect the way in which you relate to others. It will reflect the clothes that you wear. the way in which you will treat your employees, your attitudes to government. The whole of life is affected by your Christian understanding. I promised it was only going to be an overview of this section. I mean, what else can we do in 15 chapters? You'll be glad to see that there's only 34 chapters in the book, so we've really broken the back of it by the end of tonight, haven't we? We've got 2 weeks left to do the rest of the book, so we've broken the back. But we haven't started. There is the overview. There is now a lifetime ahead of you of pondering on the applications of this law to yourself. Not like the Pharisees did, minimizing its consequences, but as the New Testament does, seeking to find the principles involved and how they will relate to our life. Loving God, loving our neighbour, is to obey the commandments. When they come into the land, they're to give a great thanksgiving service. And there's no hymn which expresses thankfulness to God, I guess, as much as the number 22 with which we close tonight.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.